What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Howdy, howdy. Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. You'll notice that our middle name is Catholic, Global Catholic Network. Okay, so here we are. It's a Catholic network, and yet here we are doing a show for non-Catholics. Now, what is that all about? Well, here's what that's all about. We know that a lot of people who listen to EWTN radio and watch EWTN television are not themselves currently practicing Catholics. Well, that's great. That's fantastic. The word Catholic means universal. So we are here for everybody. And that includes our non-Catholic brothers and sisters who very often have questions about the Catholic faith. And maybe if those questions were answered to their satisfaction, they would indeed consider becoming a Catholic. So, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? What questions do you have about the Catholic faith? That's why we're here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of the U.S. and Canada, you'll want to dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text us. Text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response, then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. A little boilerplate for you there. Again, the phone number 833-288-EWTN. Charles Beery is our producer. Ryan Penny is our phone screener. Jeff Burson is on social media. If you want to pose a question via Facebook or YouTube, we're streaming live right there, right now. He'll get that message to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
You got me thinking with your comment about our middle name.
Yes.
We actually have two middle names, right? Global Catholic, EWTN, Global Catholic Radio.
Indeed.
And I was thinking about the syntactic ambiguity of that phrase. Are we Catholic radio? Are we radio for the global Catholic? Or are we global radio for the Catholic? Or both?
I'm going to let smarter people than me try to unpack that one.
I thought either one would work, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know,
because our church is global.
It is indeed.
So we're Catholic radio for radio for the global Catholic, everybody. But we're also global.
Indeed, indeed. Always looking for new opportunities to get the good news out there.
Absolutely. And you know what? When we do this show, and we hear from people all over the world, their questions about the Catholic faith in their own lives are always like cut from the same cloth. Because we're all cut from the same cloth.
Yes, indeed. All children of God. Here's a question that we received from Lorraine, who says, I am a recent convert. I am considering attending an SSPX Old Roman Catholic Church. What is the status of SSPX priests? This is the Society of St. Pius X priests. Is the Eucharist they consecrate the true body and blood of our Lord? And can they give the sacrament of reconciliation? Again, that's from Lorraine, and that she's actually talking about two different churches. There's the SSPX, and then there's the Old Catholic Church. Those are two different groups, correct?
Yes, they are. They're very different in character and theology, although, and they're different in status as well.
Okay.
My suspicion is she probably has in mind the SSPX, and she's confusing that with the Old Catholics. The Old Catholics are not Catholics, and they're not very old. They actually broke with the church in the 19th century after the First Vatican Council over the definition of papal infallibility that council promulgated. And today, the so-called Old Catholic Church tends to be not only in schism from the church and separated from unity with the Catholic faith, but also much more worldly in terms of their ethical agenda, being much more sort of like liberal, progressive, on questions of human sexuality and that kind of business.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, no, that's probably not what she's talking about. The SSPX, Society of St. Pius X, was a priestly fraternity that was formed after the Second Vatican Council for the purposes of expressing, keeping alive, promulgating traditional Latin Mass and traditional formulation of the faith And it was licit for a while until the society took the audacious step of ordaining bishops without the Pope's approval. And for that activity, their founder and those bishops were excommunicated by Pope John Paul II. And since that time, they've been operating in an irregular, non-canonical, and even schismatic state. Now, the Church has done a lot to reconcile the priests of the society and those Catholic faithful who attend Mass in their chapels to Catholic unity with mostly not success, with varying degrees of success. Some of the things the Church has done, and particularly Pope Francis, was to unilaterally grant the priests of the society jurisdiction to validly hear confessions. So prior to the pontificate of Pope Francis, the answer to your second question would have been no, they cannot validly absolve from sins or hear confessions. Now they can. Now they can. But their ability to do that is strange because, see, the way confession works is it's a sacramental but also a juridical act. Mm-hmm. And just like, a policeman in one jurisdiction is not going to go patrol in another jurisdiction, a priest has to receive the jurisdiction. He has to have the legal authority within a diocese connected to a bishop. They don't have any bishops with dioceses.
Wow.
Right? They're like husbands without wives. Somebody referred to them once as that.
Yeah.
So they couldn't receive jurisdiction to hear confessions validly or licitly, but the Pope unilaterally granted that jurisdiction by his own authority just as a kind of an act of beneficence.
Oh, yeah.
He could revoke it tomorrow. Right?
Yeah.
But for the time being, they can. They can validly but illicitly say Mass, right?
Mm-hmm.
Validly but illicitly. They cannot, either validly or licitly, witness marriages as a Catholic sacrament unless, and this is another provision the Pope made, unless the actual Catholic bishop of the diocese in which they reside grants them those faculties.
Mm.
So that would be on a diocese-by-diocese basis. They do not exercise any legitimate ministry within the Catholic Church. They have no legal standing in the Catholic Church. Their priests and bishops are in a state of active disobedience to the Pope, but they are validly ordained priests and bishops. So their sacraments, some of them, are valid and illicit and in an irregular state within the Church, so it doesn't really express the full unity of the faith that Christ desires, and so I would advise against attending one of those chapels. If you want to scratch that itch, find a parish that is celebrating the Latin Mass validly and licitly within the diocesan machinery and go there.
Stay with us. Tomorrow morning on the Sunrise Morning Show, political analyst Ken Craycraft begins a series on the so-called Equality Act. I'm sure there's a lot he'll be relaying to us. Also, how St. Anthony of Padua became the patron saint of lost items. St. Anthony, please look around. There's something I've lost that cannot be found. I'm sure you've all heard that. Anyway, check it out. How did that happen to be? Tune in tomorrow morning, the Sunrise Morning Show, with Anna Mitchell. It's a wonderful program. Tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Matt Swaim is also on the Sunrise Morning Show with Anna. I didn't want to leave him out.
Leave him out.
I'm not going to leave him out. He's a good man. Anyway, here we go on the phones with Dale in Brainerd, Minnesota, listening to us on Sirius XM 130. Hello, Dale. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on people that pray to Mary or pray so she'll invoke her blessing or whatever that is. Anyway, I realize God and Jesus are in heaven and spirit, and the Holy Spirit's here to combat the devil or help us. And I know in Revelations it talks about the devil going after the feet, and I don't know if it's Mary going after the head. Is that one reason Catholics pray, ask Mary for her help, is because she's kind of the fight? One of the ways to fight the devil, fight Satan?
Yeah, thanks. Sure, I appreciate the question. So clearly the depiction of Our Lady in Revelation chapter 12 has informed Catholic devotion to Mary. Right? That clearly is there informing our understanding of her role. As a sufficient explanation for the veneration of saints, Revelation 12 is not sufficient. Not sufficient. There's a more comprehensive case we can make for this practice. It goes all the way back to the Old Testament. So you remember in Genesis 18, when Abraham pleads with God on behalf of the city of Sodom, and he says, if you can find 10 righteous people there, will you spare the city? God says, for the sake of the 10, I'll spare the many. And so there are two things you can draw out of that passage. One of them is the fact of intercession, right? That holy and saintly people can intercede on behalf of others that are not holy or saintly, mm-hmm. and God will hear the prayers of the righteous for the sake of the few. That's Abraham interceding. But it's not only Abraham's intercession. Abraham appeals to God on behalf of a hypothetical 10 righteous people. And God says that he would be clement, merciful to the many on behalf of the righteousness of the few, right? So it's both Abraham's invocation and the state of righteousness existing in those for whose sake God would spare the many. Mm-hmm. And that theology right there that's embedded in the book of Genesis sort of informs the whole history of the Catholic relationship to the saints and the holy ones. As you know, again, from Old Testament account, when Old Testament people had a powerful relationship with God, like prophet Elijah or Moses or something, they would actually come to participate in a reflected way in God's glory, so that Moses, the people of Israel, could not even look on his face. His face had to be veiled from the Israelites because he reflected God's majesty. This Shekinah glory so imbues the holy men of old that even their dead bodies partake in a reflected, participatory way in the power of God. So in 2 Kings chapter 13, to take another example, a dead man touches the bones of Elisha the prophet. The bones of Elisha the prophet, and is brought miraculously back to life because God has ceded something of his own power, supernatural presence, even to the relics of the holy dead. So we see that this relationship of righteousness and power that inheres in the saints is something that it continues even after death, which is why when we move along in the Old Testament into passages like 2 Maccabees chapter 15, we find that the holy righteous dead intercede for God's people on earth, and we see that in the Old Testament. So do the angels participate in this ministry of reconciliation, as we see in the book of Tobit, chapter 12, where the archangel Raphael says that his job is to bring the prayers of the faithful up before the throne of God. So this business of seeing the saints and angels involved in an intercessory relationship where their prayers and their righteousness are effective for us, and they even move our prayers for us to the throne of God. That's a very biblical idea, which is why in the ancient Christian church, prayers to saints and angels have always been there, always been part of the patrimony of the church, even before the writing of the New Testament, even before these things were committed to writing. But we do see them also in the New Testament, passages like Revelation chapter 5, verse 8, or Revelation 8, verse 3. And then, of course, when you add to that what we know about the glorification of our Mother Mary from places like Revelation 12, as well as the gospel accounts of mm-hmm. the Annunciation and prophecies pertaining to her person, then that just adds like a whole layer of depth to that relationship. So Revelation chapter 12, clearly we bring that into the picture, but there's a lot more that stands behind this practice than just that one passage.
Absolutely. Dale, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. That opens up a line for you right now, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We actually have a couple of lines open for you, just to be quite honest about it. This is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here now is Susan in Jacksonville, Florida, listening on one of our very first affiliates, Queen of Peace Radio in the Jacksonville area. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I'd like to know what is the difference between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church.
Yes, thank you very much. I really appreciate the question. There are a number of differences. The first one I'd like to bring to your attention is relevant to the question, which Orthodox are you talking about, right? Because there's more than one group that claims to be Orthodox. And the different Christian groups that claim that title of Orthodox differ from one another in important ways, theologically, you know, and in other ways as well. So we can't really say that there's one thing called Orthodoxy. They don't enjoy perfect unity with one another. And that's the first difference that I'd like to point out, that within the Orthodox world, there is not a way to identify a source of unity. There's not a way to identify a source of unity for everyone who would call themselves Orthodox. But within the Catholic Church, there is a way to identify a source of unity. Everyone in the world who is Catholic identifies with everybody else in the world who is Catholic in virtue of our obedience to the Bishop of Rome. That's what it means, in part, to be Catholic, that we submit to the authority of the Bishop of Rome, who happens to be the Pope. So that's why we're all one. We may disagree about all kinds of stuff, but it's disagreements within the family,
okay,
right? Because we are all under obedience to the Bishop of Rome.
Right.
That is what the Orthodox, the most important thing, where they differ from us. They are not in obedience to the Bishop of Rome, and as a result, they lack a source of visible unity, and so they fracture into many smaller groups, and they argue with one another, and they can't get on the same page. Recently, within the last year or so, the Orthodox attempted to hold their own council and to gather together not all the Orthodox, but just a significant sample of Orthodox. They couldn't pull it off.
Wow.
They couldn't even agree enough to hold a meeting, right? Because they couldn't even agree on the order of precedence in the meeting and who should be invited and who shouldn't and all this kind of business. So they lack that sort because they don't submit to the authority of the Bishop of Rome. That's the most important and significant difference between Catholics and Orthodox, is about the authority of the Pope, and they reject the authority of the Pope, right? Another important difference is that the Catholic Church was founded immediately by Christ, under the authority of St. Peter. In Matthew 16, when our Lord said to St. Peter, "You are the rock on which I will build the church's unity." That's a, you know, rough translation. And I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and what you bind on earth is bound in heaven. Christ signaled his intent to establish the church on the rock of unity that is St. Peter. So the Catholic Church has been there from the beginning, from its foundation by Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The Orthodox Church, as a distinct religious body, didn't really come into existence until the Middle Ages. Now, there were Eastern Christians who celebrated the liturgy with different language and different emphases and sometimes a different theological expression. The Eastern Christians have been there from the beginning. They used to be part of the Church's Catholic unity.
Mm.
But in the Middle Ages, progressively, starting in about the 11th century, but then over the next few centuries, they grew further and further away politically from the Bishop of Rome until finally they just, you know, kind of became their own thing and split off and went their own way. And there are other differences in theological emphasis, but the most important one is their relationship to the Bishop of Rome.
Very good. Susan, does that answer your question?
I'd like to know if they believe in Trinity.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes, very much so. The Orthodox are strongly committed to the doctrine of the Trinity. Yes, thank you.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much, Susan. And this is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Right now, we're going to go to a call that we received overnight on our listener comment line.
My name is Luke. I'd like to know, in the Episcopal Church, they say the same creed as the Catholic Church does, and everything seems to be the same. How do you explain that? Is it a false religion?
Hi, Luke. Thank you very much for the question. So the reason that the Episcopal Church professes the same creed in their liturgy as the Catholic Church is that they took it from the Catholic Church. That's right. That's where they got it from. And the origin of the Episcopal Church, of course, was in the 16th century in England, when the Church of England was Catholic, and the King of England wanted to divorce his wife and marry another woman, and he appealed to the Pope for an annulment of his previous marriage, wanted permission to take another woman whom he, turns out he'd already impregnated. Pope said no. Christ said what God has joined together, man can't separate, not going to let you separate from your lawful wife. And so the King of England said, well, tell you what I'm going to do, Pope, I'm going to separate from you. And he went off and pulled all the priests and bishops that he could muster out of the Catholic Church into a new religious body called the Church of England. And a few people refused to go with him. They are martyrs of the Catholic Church because he cut their heads off for their pains. That's the origin of the Episcopal Church. But he wanted to pull a fast one on the people of England when he pulled away from Catholic unity. So he tried to make his church look as much like the Catholic Church as possible, except that instead of the Pope, he put, wait for it, the King of England at the head of the church, which is why it's called the Church of England and not the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is not the Church of England. It's the Church of the whole world. Catholic means universal. His was the Church of England, his little church, his little country, doing his little bidding.
So there it is.
There
All
it
right.
is.
And thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have a line open for you right now, 833-288-3986. Barbara sent us an email. She says, I have so many questions, but the biggest one is, why does God choose circumcision as the sign of his covenant? Doesn't that exclude women from union with God?
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, first of all, no one has to circumcise their child now to be a full participant in the covenant with God, which is in Christ and is by faith, and into which we enter through baptism, irrespective of sex. In Christ, there's no male, female, slave, free, etc., etc. In the Old Covenant, the reason for the circumcision of male infants, circumcision is in the organ of the transmission of life, you understand? And it was through Abraham that the covenant was transmitted to his progeny. And so it is symbolically significant that in the very mode of transmission of that lineal descent from Abraham, the Jewish male would be marked with a sign of his fidelity to the God of the covenant. Didn't mean that females were excluded from the covenant people of God. They were not. But it's because of its particular connection to that patrilineal descent through Abraham in the organ of generation, it would seem, that God selected this as the particular sign of covenant membership.
Okay, very good. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Caitlin sent us an email. If one does receive communion when not properly disposed, how would they be in danger? How would danger manifest itself?
Spiritual death and a hardening in one's heart towards the things of God. So let us say that a man is in mortal sin and he is wounded in his conscience as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And he desires to be reconciled with God. And he desires to be reconciled to God in the Eucharist. And so he makes the takes the proper steps for a valid absolution of his sins. He may be, perhaps his sin is concupiscence, for example, or flows from concupiscence,
okay.
You know. But in his heart, he desires to be united to God, but he's weak. He's weak. And so he's fallen into grave sin because of his weakness, but he wants to be reconciled properly. He does so.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Fine. Well, he's restored to fellowship. But imagine that he dismisses the need for reconciliation and marches forward presumptuously to Holy Communion. Now he has seared his conscience and made it permanently harder for him to ever come to repentance again. He may seal his fate and be lost.
Sounds dangerous to me.
May. I didn't say he would.
Sure.
He
sure.
might.
Caitlin, thanks for your email. Plenty straight ahead right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. It's EWTN Radio's Call to Communion. If you've been waiting to call us, now is your opportunity. We've got a couple lines open, and we're waiting to hear from you. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's an email from Mark who says, I think if I saw that there were a few leading world scientists who were devout Catholics or converts and read about what inspired their belief, it would help me buy into Catholicism more and not be quite so skeptical. Also, I have seen many people in the Catholic community treat priests, bishops, and cardinals, even the Pope, like they're some kind of celebrities. Is this how God intended the roles of these figures to be treated?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. I think we'd have to say that the protocols around the Catholic treatment of popes and patriarchs and bishops and so forth are accidental to their nature and office. In other words, these are historical accretions that evolved, especially during the time of the imperial government of ancient Rome, and partook to a certain extent of that imperial quality. And because things tend to perdure for a long time once they're well established, those traditions have endured in the Catholic Church, and they may serve a utilitarian function of recalling to people's mind the importance of the office. And respect for the episcopal dignity and priestly dignity, say nothing of the papal dignity. Does that mean that they have to be expressed always in the same way, with the same kind of pomp and circumstance? The answer to that question is no. And, you know, the abandonment of the papal tiara would be an example. The popes have changed their dress. They're no longer carried in these divans, you know, like Middle Eastern potentates around, mm-hmm. you know, with on people's shoulders and so forth. So there have been changes in the expression of that protocol at a deference to the more, I think, democratic sensibility of the modern age. And such changes can certainly be contemplated and may actually, in fact, be implemented. Pope Francis did one, actually, shortly after becoming pope. He did away with the dignity of the title Monsignor to be bestowed on priests of you know, age and nobility.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed the currently Monsignorified priests to continue in that title and that dignity till death, but no new Monsignors are being named. And so, you know, considerations like the ones that you have raised, there are some religious orders mm-hmm. within the Catholic Church that have both ordained priests as members as well as lay brothers, and traditionally they would have differentiated among themselves, you know, Father so-and-so from Brother so-and-so. But it's not uncommon today in some religious orders for those distinctions not to be referenced in common address, and they might refer to everybody in the religious order as brother, whether they're ordained priest or not. But that would differ, you know, depending on the order. So, sure, these things, they exist. You know, certain dignities and trappings of office are appropriate, but none are written in stone, so to speak, and they are to a certain extent, variable with time and circumstance.
Okay. And what about the first part of that regarding leading world scientists who become Catholic? There are very many leading world scientists who are Catholic.
Oh, sure. Right. Exactly. You know, and many of them major contributors to the progress of modern science as we know. I mean, one that comes to mind, of course, is Gregor Mendel, the Benedictine monk, who was the father of modern genetics. And, you know, I could come up with several more if you gave me a minute.
I believe it was a Catholic priest who came up with the Big Bang Theory.
That's right. That's right. You're right. You're correct.
Very good. All right, back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to go to Father Deacon Lawrence. He is a Byzantine Catholic deacon. Father Deacon, what's on your mind today?
I just heard the explanation when a woman asked about the difference between the Orthodox and Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded like, Dr. Anders, what you said was the Orthodox went off on their own, split away from the Catholic Church. And I always, it irks me when I hear that, because there was a papal bull delivered from Rome to Constantinople, put on the holy table, and then the deacon took off. There was a deacon in the Eastern Church in Hagia Sophia who tried to get the Roman the deacon from the West to take it back, and he wouldn't. So I don't know. It seems like a lot of times things between the East and West, when they're talked about, couple times on your show, but several times on Catholic Answers in years past, and I've talked with people about that and written and communicated, and haven't heard anything in a while, but it's just, it's a little scary to me. Metropolitan Callistos Ware, who's one of the leading spokesmen for the Orthodox Church in the world, he says what we need to do is go back to where we had agreement before the split and move forward from there. And that's really what needs to happen. And St. John Paul the Great, as Pope John Paul II, asked the Ukrainian Catholic Cardinal Lubomir, who we would refer to as a patriarch, asked him, who could I bring to try to bring unity between East and West? And he referred him to Metropolitan Callistos and a couple others. And I think there are a lot of people who are Orthodox who want unity with the West. And to talk about it like the Orthodox just went off and broke off from the Catholic Church, it's not accurate and it's not helpful.
I appreciate that commentary, Father Deacon, and I understand the point you're making, and I recognize it. I'm not gonna argue the point because I think you're correct. And if I am, in particular, if I am speaking to someone who is Orthodox, and about how we can work towards unity, I'm not going to start the conversation with saying, well, you know, you guys broke away from Catholic unity in obedience to the Pope.
Yeah,
that's not
helpful.
How I'm going to characterize it. And I have Orthodox friends, and I, when speaking to them, I tend to focus on those points that we have in common. If I'm answering a question from someone who does not know whether or not the Orthodox believe in the Trinity, right, which is like very little historical information about mm-hmm. it, and I'm trying to figure out how can I summarize the theological distinction that is most essential between the two traditions. In my judgment, that distinction would be what is the status of the Bishop of Rome, in particular, the Catholic claim to his universal jurisdiction, and how can I put that in a way that is understandable to somebody who lacks historical knowledge, and I can do it in a, you know, a 2 to 3 minute radio spot. And that would seem to me it's not an inaccurate summary, at least especially from the Catholic point of view, to characterize the Orthodox relationship to Catholicism as one of rejecting the universal jurisdiction of the Bishop of Rome. And I don't think that's inaccurate historically or theologically, and it does capture what is at essence the major theological distinction between the traditions. Is that a sufficient characterization of the two traditions and what stands in the path of Catholic unity? Clearly not. Clearly not. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with Father Aidan Nichols' book, Rome and the Eastern Churches, which is one of my personal favorites in understanding this relationship. And it's generous in its treatment of Orthodoxy, although doesn't shy away from that question of the universal jurisdiction of the Pope. And I'm familiar with the documents that you cite, and I understand that Pope John Paul II, in a kind of an evocative way, asks the entire Christian world to look to the example of the first 1,000 years, not as a sufficient way of overcoming the distinctions between East and West, or not East and West, but between Catholic and Orthodox, but as a fruitful common ground from which further elaboration might develop. Again, it's not sufficient to look to the first 1,000 years because there's been a lot of specific dogmatic definition within the Catholic world since then. Think about the Reunion Council of Florence, especially the infallible Holy Council of Trent and all the specific formulations that came out from that, as well as the First Vatican Council. We can't simply walk back infallibly proclaimed dogmas. But clearly the first 1,000 years need to be the common ground that we, from which we begin the dialogue for full reconciliation between those two communions. But again, I really appreciate the corrective, and I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Father Deacon, do call us back. We'd love to hear from you again. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. We have a line open for you at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Stephen is listening in Portland on Mater Dei Radio. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Hello. I have a family member who's unwilling to join the Catholic Church or rejoin. They're falling away. Mm-hmm. Because they say, one reason, we are unwilling to let them, they live together in an uncommitted, unmarried situation, unwilling to let them visit us and stay in one room. We would give them separate rooms, whereas we would give another married family members the same room, even though their marriage is obviously much less loving and functional and wonderful as theirs is. And we won't allow that because of this marriage idea. They just feel like we've totally allowed marriage to supersede reality.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the number of things that we have to bring into conversation here, one of them is a so-called, well, let's first of all examine this question of whether or not a relationship is loving. What that means, all right? Are we talking about affable, agreeable,
friendly?
You know, friendly, right? Exactly, because it seems to me that if I say to a human being, another person, a woman, I am willing to cohabitate with you for now, as long as it pleases me, but when it ceases to please me, I will stop cohabitating with you. That's very, very different from the statement, I will lay down my life and die before I leave you. I will be reliably there for you until you die, even if it kills me. For better or for worse, you can go crazy. You can become neurotic. You know, all kinds of bad things could happen. You could throw things at my head. And I'm not going to leave, no matter how difficult it becomes, because I'm going to be there for you no matter what. That strikes me as two very different kinds of relationships. And we fortify the relationship of marriage with a vow precisely because it's difficult. And it will almost inevitably entail some of those problems aforementioned. And, you know, what is love? Does love simply mean affability, agreeability, you know, getting along? Or does love entail the willingness to endure sacrifice for the sake of the other? And the other thing that's involved in that objection is the idea that there's nothing involved in marriage, just discussion about marriage and reality, beyond you know, the personal agreement of the people involved, as if there weren't larger social or societal consequences to the vow of marriage. But there are, and marriage is inescapably a public act. And as such, it necessarily or ought to entail societal approbation, approval, and sanction. And so it's entirely fitting that culture and law would come to the defense of that sacred bond of lifelong commitment, no matter what, till death do us part, for better or for worse. And that we express our societal, cultural, or legal disapproval of casual coupling that would separate that bond between parents and their children in consequence, which has, that the loss of that bond, of course, has done so much harm to kids since the liberalization of divorce laws in this country and the social liberalization towards divorce in the last 50 years or so.
Mm.
So, and yeah, if you don't like that, if you don't recognize that there is a substantive difference between promising to be with somebody till next Thursday and let's share a bed and venereal pleasure until then versus being with someone for life for the sake of raising a family, even when we cease to be able to share sexual pleasure with one another for the sake of raising a children because of old age or infirmity or sickness or whatever, I'm still not going to leave you no matter what. If they can't see that those are qualitatively different moral states and conditions, then yeah, I'd say that's a good reason not to be Catholic, right? And they, you know, if they're not willing to yield to that truth about the nature of the human person in society, then I would say, yeah, you're not ready to become Catholic yet.
And certainly Stephen can do whatever he wants with his house.
He can do whatever he wants with his house.
Absolutely. Stephen, thank you so much for your call. It is called a communion here on EWTN. We have a line open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. In a moment, we'll be getting to Brenda in Des Moines. I was speaking with somebody yesterday about a program that they were asking about. I said, oh, that show is on EWTN Radio Classics. And I was going to say something else, and she said, whoa, 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 what are you talking about? EWTN Radio Classics, what is that? Well, she didn't know that EWTN has yet another radio outreach, and that is a 24-hour channel dedicated to teachings and devotionals, programs from, you know, series, whole series from Mother Angelica, Dr. Scott Hahn, you know, Bishop Fulton Sheen, Father Benedict Groeschel. We carry the Encore of the Mass every day on Radio Classics. We carry the Rosary, I think, four times a day, including a special children's rosary that airs in the afternoon so your kids can pray along in their own special way. We air the Divine Mercy Chaplet at 3 o'clock. All these different things happen 24 hours a day on EWTN Radio Classics. And there's a couple of ways that you can access that. You can check it out by going to EWTNradio.net. Look for the little box that says EWTN Radio Classics. Click on that. You are good to go. You can also listen on the EWTN app, which is a free download. Listen there. You could also walk up to your Alexa device and say, Alexa, play EWTN Radio Classics. Boom, it starts playing whatever is going on at that moment. So don't forget about the other EWTN radio, and that is EWTN Radio Classics. Back to the phones now for Brenda in Des Moines, listening on Iowa Catholic Radio. Hey, Brenda, what's on your mind today?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is my very favorite show of Catholic radio, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I really love it. My question is, I'm one of nine children, and we're all old now, and of the nine, we grew up Lutheran, and when I married my husband when I was 20, I converted to Catholicism at age 21, so I've been Catholic for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I feel pretty comfortable talking to my, I have one sister who converted also, but the rest are Lutheran, and so I feel comfortable now talking to them about maybe being open to the Catholic faith. And my oldest sibling, my sister, is Missouri Synod. When I grew up, I was ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they had a feud about if they could have gay pastors, and so they split on that. But anyway, so she went to Missouri Synod. We were talking, and I didn't grow up Missouri Synod. What are the main differences between Missouri Synod and Catholicism? And then what are the main differences between Missouri Synod, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, Lutheran Church of America? I mean, there's so many different Lutherans.
I understand.
Wisconsin.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened within Lutheranism is very similar to what has happened to other historic Protestant denominations. Of course, as you know, Luther stands behind Lutheranism, the progenitor of that movement, and it got formalized in the 16th century around a certain set of doctrinal statements, in particular the Augsburg Confession, later the Book of Concord, define the content of Lutheran belief and practice. And it's been more or less the same. Those confessional statements have been handed down to Lutherans by their tradition for the last 500 years, stayed more or less unchanged on paper. In the same way, Presbyterians take their origin from the Westminster Assembly, Westminster Confession of Faith, and you can point to similar process in other Protestant denominations. Some early body of believers banded together, put out a doctrinal statement, system of discipline and practice, and then handed that down to their progeny as their tradition. But in subsequent generations, there may be variations within the family of Lutherans or within the family of Presbyterians or the family of Baptists over how seriously they take their own doctrinal statements, how seriously they take adherence to their own tradition. And, putting it lightly, some of them learn to say their creeds with their fingers crossed behind their back.
Ooh.
Right, if you understand. Mm. And you can characterize these traditions with as being, say, more conservative or more liberal in their interpretation of their own tradition. And this is true of Lutheranism as well as other Protestant denominations. And so within Lutheranism, you had fractures over this kind of question about how much to move with the spirit of the progressive spirit of the age or how much to cling to the faith of their fathers. Within American Lutheranism, the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, is perceived as being more liberal, modernist, and Missouri Synod, Wisconsin Synod appear as being more conservative, more, you know, they all have the same doctrinal statement on paper, right? How faithfully they adhere to it, with how much seriousness they take it, differs from denomination to denomination.
Okay.
So that's kind of the difference between those groups. In terms of how does Lutheranism in general, or Missouri Synod specifically, differ from the Catholic Church? Well, most importantly, Catholic Church was founded by Jesus Christ in 33 AD, all right, on the rock of St. Peter, and the unity of the Church proceeds from that Petrine origin. And the Lutheran Church was founded by Martin Luther. Someplace 1517 at the earliest to say, 1530s at the latest. And of course, the difference between Luther and Christ is the difference between a flawed human being and the all-powerful, eternally preexistent Son of God. So that's a pretty big difference. All right. They also differ in their understanding of the path of salvation. This is a very, very, very big difference. Luther taught that a man can be saved, woman too, can be saved simply by faith alone, and the faith that saves is the faith that believes I am saved.
Mm.
So in the act of believing that I have been saved, in that act, I am in fact saved, irrespective of the moral quality of my life. So Luther was kind of prone to hyperbole, but he is famous for having said, it doesn't matter if I murder or commit adultery or idolatry or whatever heinous thing I might do. I could do it 10,000 times in a day, and it's not going to affect my relationship with God, my ultimate destiny in God. The Catholic Church says, it matters very much how you live your life, and that faith unites us to God, but if we don't continue in fellowship with Him in charity, then we can separate ourselves from the love of God and be damned, even if we are believers. So faith alone, on Luther's position, or a faith that unites us to God in charity, on the Catholic side. We also differ in how we understand religious truth. So Luther thought that we could know everything that God wanted us to know by consulting the Bible alone. And the Catholic Church says, no, the Bible itself is a product of Catholic tradition, which is given to us by Christ. If you throw out Catholic tradition, you better throw out the Bible too, because the Bible is a product of Catholic tradition. We have the deposit of faith handed to us by Christ, both in the tradition of the Church and in sacred Scripture, as interpreted by the Church's teaching authority, the Sacred Magisterium. So big differences there. There are many other differences as well, but those are the big ones.
Okay. Brenda, thank you so much for your call. How long have we been doing this show now? How many years? 4 years, 5 years?
Something like that.
Something like that. I'm about to reveal to David something that he did not know about me. My very first exposure to professional radio was as a kid growing up in St. Louis. There was a local radio station owned by Concordia Seminary, which is Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and they launched a teenage discussion show, panel show, interspersed with progressive rock music.
There you go.
Kind of a hippie seminarian that ran the thing. And it was very, very enjoyable. I mean, I learned a few things about radio. That was really why I was involved with it. But they were very kind to me. And that was how I got started in all this.
Now, you said that was your first foray into professional radio. It was not your first foray into radio, though, was it?
That would have been my pirate radio station in my basement. We're not going to talk about that because I don't know what the statute of limitations is, with the FCC. They might still come after me. Anyway, I'm sorry we could not
get... You didn't hear it here.
That's right. That's right. I know nothing about any of that. I want to thank everybody who called in today. I could not get to Bruce in Center Reach. We just have a couple of seconds, Bruce. If you would please call us back tomorrow at the same time, I promise we will put you at the head of the line and give your call the time that it deserves. So what do you think, Dave? Did we answer everybody's questions, hopefully sufficiently?
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all we can do.
If not, we tackle it again tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Do appreciate everybody who participates in some way, and that includes you on the other side of the radio. We know that you love the truth. That's why you come here. You want to find out what the Catholic Church is really all about, and that's why we bring it to you each and every day on Call to Communion, Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern here on EWTN. We also encore the show for you tonight at and every weeknight at 11 p.m. Eastern. We also have a best of Call to Communion on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, you can check out the podcast 24 hours a day by going to EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our producer, Charles, our phone screener, Ryan, and Jeff Burson on social media, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Still looking out for that FCC guy. Oh, boy. Hey, we'll see you tomorrow. God bless.